Okay.
Somebody, me and Rhonda Roffa here from Broward, if you have spaces, we can talk about the Everglades agricultural area. Okay. If you have a slide,
All right, I think we're ready now. Our first presentation for the afternoon session is from Dr. Bill Dunson. Dr. Dunson received his Bachelor in Science in Zoology from Yale University in 1962 and his PhD in Zoology from the University of Michigan in 1965. He was a professor of biology at Penn State University from 65 through 97. From 97 to 2002, he served as the biologist for the Seminole tribe in Big Cyprus. His special area of expertise included freshwater and estuarine physiological ecology, ecotoxicology of ponds affected by acid rain, of coal mines, polluted streams, and of naturally acidic waters, osmoregulation of estuarine and marine reptiles, endangered species, and herpetology. He's published more than 120 scientific papers in peer-reviewed journals. Charlotte County retained Dr. Dunson as a technical expert for the Peace River option and the Ona Fort DeSoto mine permit legal case. He's a member of the scientific peer review panel for the PRMRWSA, dealing with ecological impacts of freshwater withdrawals on Charlotte Harbor and Peace River Estuary. He's also a resident of Charlotte County, thank goodness for us, concerned about the impacts of mining in his community. So Dr. Bill Dunson will be speaking, Monitoring Inadequacies and Alternatives, Designing a Water Quality Monitoring Plan for Phosphate Mining, a Critique of the Horse Creek Stewardship Program.
Can you pull up my PowerPoint?
I will.
This is going to be a bit of a shift. I was quite interested in the material this morning. It was a lot more interesting than I thought it would be. There's obviously a lot of pent-up knowledge and emotion that's just, you know, waiting to burst out. I know I was back there, you know, trying to get called on, but like I say, too many mouths going. But this is going to be a bit of a shift, at least for my talk. It's what I call science anyway, and I'm trying to bring it down to a level that most of you will not put you completely to sleep. Before I start on that, I wanted to make one comment since I couldn't get recognized this morning. There was a little discussion about minimum flows and levels, you remember that? And the idea was put forward that this is a bit of a potential salvation for our situation in that if the minimum flows and levels are set based on scientific criteria, this should prevent, you know, mines and water authorities and, you know, various other overuses of water from taking place. Theoretically, this may be the case, but I serve on this panel, the Peace River Minnesota Regional Water Supply Authority, which of course is under the aegis of Swift Mud. So we're in one of the five water districts here, Swift Mud, which science and Swift Mud are basically oxymorons. There is no science in Swift Mud. Instead, there's a political apparatus which exists to carry out the will of whatever politicians, you know, have their hand in the pocket, in the right pocket at the right time. So problem with the minimum flows and levels in this particular case, you said you're going to give me something I could push to advance.
Well,
this.
I think if you just hit
enter. Just for an example, you know, here's Charlotte Harbor. So here we are. We're right underneath the O in Charlotte Harbor here in Hoopa, Florida. So the Peace River, you know, is going all the way up to Lake Hancock and Lakeland. We were presented with a document a month or so ago to evaluate the consultant's report. And this is a consultant named Tony Janicki, who does a huge amount of work for the Water District, for DEP. He's well regarded because he's a very smart guy and technically very competent, but he has the same problem as this mining consultant who would not come here. He cannot produce anything that strays from the bounds of what his clients, you know, deem acceptable. And you will find one example of his handiwork here we're going to be discussing this morning, namely the trigger criteria for water quality have been set so high that basically the miners will never reach it. You know, and that's a very handy thing to have, to know that you're never going to pollute. And Tony Janicki sat on this panel, and behind closed doors he told someone, you know, these are like insanely high levels, but what came out was the insanely high levels, you know, because that's the way the system works. He also wrote this minimum flows and levels report, which deals with the Lower Peace River and Shell Creek. Well, Shell Creek is in everybody's crosshairs because there's so-called extra water there. The Fort DeSoto plant, which sits right about up here, doesn't have enough water. The Peace River's gone dry. It's getting too salty. So they're building a huge pipeline. They're going to dig right across the Peace River and go sucking all that. And you're going to hear a giant sucking sound coming out of Shell Creek. Does Shell Creek have extra water? Almost certainly not. You know, it has a dam, which a local resident was just telling me there's hardly any water flowing over the top of it at all right now. So basically, they're doing minimum flows and levels for each of these tributaries separately. They're not doing a minimum flows and levels for Charlotte Harbor. You know, for my way of thinking, you should start at the bottom where the water is coming, figure out how much water this needs, and then figure out how to allocate this amongst the tributaries. They're doing just the opposite. They're taking them, they're basically a divide and conquer strategy, one at a time, and then they're not going to consider the impact on Charlotte Harbor at all. And this plan, which they have developed, namely Janicki, in conjunction with a guy named Sid Flannery, who's the so-called scientist, you know, at Swift Mud in Brooksville, is to take up to 85% of the water out of Shell Creek at various times. And, you know, there's no science in it whatsoever. It's a mathematical model, completely artificially constructed. I doubt that the minimum flow and levels on other streams are done all that differently. I know I did look once many years ago at the Hillsborough and found that it was similarly, you know, completely lacking any kind of ecological input. So rather than thinking that minimum flows and levels are a solution, I can see that now they're going to be a huge problem, because once this is set, even though they can be changed, it now opens up all the water that flows above the minimum flows and levels. It opens it up for immediate use. And so everybody's going to come piling in and want to use it. It's a very similar situation to changing from septics to sewage. I live on Manasota Key. We had septic tanks when I first moved here in 94. Now we're all on sewage. Well, probably, maybe it leads to less runoff into the bay. But what it definitely led to was huge numbers of condominiums being built on the island, because now you have sewer. So like I say, don't always assume that these things that at first sight seem to be good regulations will always lead to something good. And I'm going to be talking about one set of those regulations today, which particularly deal with something that you probably never heard of, the Horse Creek Stewardship Program. The reason this is important is that this was part of an agreement between Charlotte County and the mining company, which at the time was IMC, which is now Mosaic, to monitor for any potential harmful effects on the ecology of Horse Creek.
Bill, do you need help with that? Do you want me to sit there and advance it for you?
That'd be good, if you don't mind. Yeah, so push the down right now. Okay, so here's Charlotte Harbor, Peace River. So the one of the major tributaries, the first major tributaries other than Myakka, flowing from the north is Horse Creek. Horse Creek is relatively, I don't like the word pristine, but it's relatively unaffected. It has some mining, some agriculture. But the mines, of course, are moving, the phosphate miners are moving to the south and are gradually, you know, are looking to put very large mines in this area. And somebody made the comment this morning that the miners had said, well, they were going to make Horse Creek better than it was to start with. Of course, this is a colossal joke, and I'll explain a little more details about that as we go. So anyway, in the process of negotiating some mine permits, a plan was developed for Horse Creek, which would supposedly monitor it and be ironclad. And unfortunately, these deals are always negotiated at the last moment, very rapidly and in secret. And they're negotiated by lawyers and consultants like Janicki, Swift Mud, and the local water authorities. And the result might seem okay. You know, when you read through it, you know, they're measuring animals and plants, you know, they're taking water samples, they're doing this and that. But when I looked at it in detail, being an expert on ecotoxicology, I find that it's basically a complete waste of time. It's just a waste of money. It's not going to accomplish, you know, what it was supposed to accomplish. Next slide. This is just to give you a brief idea of what we're dealing with. They proposed a list of chemical substances and concentrations and things like specific conductance, which is like everything together, which has an electrical charge or carries an electrical charge, they proposed so-called trigger levels that if the water samples went above this level, so for example, if nitrogen went above 3.0 milligrams per liter, that action would be taken. Many of these values, if you know anything about this, for example, I think in the Everglades, isn't it 5 micrograms or 5 parts per billion that they're trying to set as a trigger level? Here they're talking about 2,500, you know. Of course, you have to know what the effect is on the local system. The Peace River is a historically system rich in phosphorus, and you would need to have some information about, you know, how these levels have impacts. In most cases, we don't have these levels, but I'm going to suggest a means by which we could come up with a better, more environmentally accurate set of triggers than however they came up with these, which is, let's set it so damn high that, you know, we'll never have to worry about it. So I've just picked out a couple of these, and I'll go through these and explain how I came up with the idea that, well, they're saying orthophosphorus should be never be above 2.5 milligrams per liter, which is a huge, huge amount. Well, from what I can see, certainly total phosphorus, which is a much bigger number, should never be above like 0.75, you know, so on and so forth. They've set specific conductance at 1275, and I don't think it should be above 250, and I'll give you several sets of evidence which indicate that. Next slide. So a good problem we have here is we did not have any water quality monitoring back in 1890. I mean, someone gave a figure for, what was it, 500,000 people in Florida in 1900? Was that the figure?
Yeah.
Which sounds like a lot of people when you spread them all over the entire state. And certainly if you looked at what was going on in this particular area, you know, not much would have been going on, except that phosphate mining started in the Peace River in the late 1800s. So there was some pretty massive mining going on. A lot of it was actually done in the river itself. They were getting sediments out of the bottom of the river. So undoubtedly, this had a devastating effect on the water quality. And we know this even from more recent episodes in which, you know, huge spills occurred and there's all this silt in the river and so on and so forth. So given that we don't know what it was like before, how can you make any predictions about what levels would be safe? Next slide. Well, I came up with a technique that doesn't seem that bizarrely irrational or anything, but that is to look at a series of rivers which are the least impacted at the top and kind of get worse and worse. And sort of in here, like the first three, the St. Mary's is probably, and I can't say this for sure because I haven't, you know, no one's given me a couple $100,000 to do a decent study, but it's got to be one of the cleanest rivers in the state. Does anybody know what the watershed is for the St. Mary's River? It's the Okefenokee Swamp. So actually it's in mostly in Georgia. Aside from what? There's a titanium mine that DuPont had run there for many years. And I think they finally closed that down. But anyway, it doesn't seem to be having much impact on the St. Mary's anyway. I don't know if it does on the Suwannee. The Myakka, of course, is a relatively short river, 125 miles or so. It has a lot of agricultural impact, and I'll show you some evidence of that. Not very much mining. Horse Creek has, again, ag impact with a little bit of mining. Payne Creek runs right out of the center of Polk County Mines, this enormous area which has been mined very heavily. It's very polluted. Peace River is kind of the, you know, toilet bowl flush from everything. You know, a lot of mining, a lot of this, a lot of that. And then the south prong of the Alafaya, again, which runs the other direction, it runs over to towards Tampa. 60 to 70% of the basin has been mined, so enormous impacts of mining. It's actually cleaner now than it was 20 years ago because of the impact of a lot of regulations. Next slide. Okay, so the St. Mary's, as I say, well, people will say, well, what the heck does this have to do with anything? Well, like I say, it's a blackwater river like our other rivers, which probably originally was extremely pure. Because generally blackwater rivers flow out of very sandy soils with very few nutrients, and there's not much in the water, you know, less than, you know, 1 milligram per liter potassium, less than usually 50 microsiemens per centimeter of specific conductance. Next slide. So the Myakka, you know, doesn't look all that different. Again, a blackwater river flowing out of very sandy flatwoods kind of habitat. Next slide. So the data that we do have, you can go to usgs.gov, and there's just a goldmine of information in there on water flow, chemistry, you know, over many, many years. Unfortunately, they only measure a relatively limited suite of chemicals, so we got to go with what they've got. So for example, here we have the data between the mid-60s and 2000, and here I'm plotting the specific conductance. Sometimes it's less accurately called conductivity. So it's just kind of the all of the charged ions which are floating around in the water. You don't know what they are, but generally all of them. So this is like 0 to 800 microsiemens per centimeter. So you can see back even in the 60s, you know, which is pretty late in the history of development of the area, it's like less than 100. But now it's gone up 5 or 6 fold, you know, during this last 40 years. Next slide. Now here's potassium, and it turns out potassium, even though it's an innocuous element unless you inject it into your blood, any of you who are interested in murdering somebody, if you inject a concentrated solution of potassium into your bloodstream, it stops your heart, and then they analyze the body later and say, oh, it's filled with potassium, which the body is full of. So good tip to remember. So here we're looking at potassium over that same 40 years. 0 to 9 milligrams per liter, and as I mentioned before, the purest rivers and even the Mayaca, which you know has a lot of activity around it, started below 1 milligram per liter, and if they're not, then something has been going on. But then now, 40 years later, 5 or 6 times as much potassium in there. Next slide. It turns out this potassium is a good way of judging ag impact. It's different from mining. So what we need is a sort of a way of telling, well, if you have this kind of mine in the watershed, or you have this kind of agricultural activity or whatever, it has essentially a footprint or a fingerprint that you can see in analyzing the water. So I'm going to do this just very, very gently by looking at our 6 different rivers. So there's the cleanest that this is in, St. Mary's, the Mayaca, the Horse, the Payne, the Arcadia, the South Prong, the Alligator. And then the value is getting higher, and we're using a thing that's called a box whisker plot, which is like the median, 75%, 95%, just to kind of compare the 5 rivers. So for potassium, you can see that the St. Mary's, again, is down around 0.3 milligrams per liter, so incredibly low, even today, you know. But Mayaca is pretty high, the Horse is even higher. And then the mine-affected ones really are lower. So that's the point I was trying to make. Although you can get potassium from mining, potassium in the water actually tells you that you have a lot of agricultural activity in the watershed. Next slide. Just skip over that one. Next slide. So when we did this kind of analysis, looking at the data that are available from USGS and using these 6 rivers as a comparison of the cleanest to the kind of the dirtiest, we found that the mined areas, which had phosphate mines in their watersheds, were higher in specific conductance, sodium, calcium, magnesium, sulfate, fluoride, and total phosphorus. And particularly, I mentioned that potassium is the best indicator of agricultural activity. Fluoride is by far the best indicator of phosphate mining activity. I'll show you the evidence for that. Next slide. So just very briefly, I'm just going to run through these to have you see that. So the cleanest one here, specific conductance is about 55 or so, but the mined ones are even higher. So given a plot like that, and like here we have Horse Creek, and here we have the heavily mine-affected ones, so where would you draw the trigger level for specific conductance?
If you are
the person asked to do it. So the Horse Creek Stewardship Study, which is the result of science, you know, consultants interacting with vested interests, decided that the level should be 1,275. So where's 1,275 on this graph?
It's
up in the roof.
That little raising platform.
So how do you suppose they decided that, even though the most heavily polluted streams were only 300 to 350, the clean streams are like, you know, 50 to 250, to set it at 1275. Like I say, there's no science in that. It's just pure politics. It's greed, self-interest, and everything. So the problem, I mean, this should be nothing new to us. We know that all this stuff that goes on behind closed doors with consultants who are paid by special interests, they're not going to represent the people. So it's the same old story. You've got to bring this out into the public. You've got to have commissioners who can even at least understand it, or even if they could understand it, to care about it. And you have to have them hire people who are outside. You know, people like myself, you know, scientists who are from academia or something, who have no financial, you know, or political interest in the outcome, but who should be giving you, you know, their own decision or their own recommendation. Their recommendation may be biased in various ways, and you need a number of these people to kind of play these interests off, but at least they're not going to be giving you such whoppers as this. Next slide.
This is called just add a zero method. Seriously.
Yeah, there's a name for
it. Just add a zero. Keep that mic closed.
Okay, so here's sodium. So here's the clean streams and the dirty streams. And again, you can see Horse Creek is way below everything, but occasionally Pain Creek gets down into that area. So, you know, so I'm recommending that you draw a line somewhere in here. If you're trying to protect Horse Creek, you can take the highest values, you know, even, or you could even drop it down and catch a few of the outliers and say everything above that is a problem. So like I said, this is one way to do it. There would be two or three other ways I can think of to set these also. Next slide. So here's calcium. Now you might ask, well, sodium, calcium, potassium, these are not toxic materials. Why should they even be a consequence? Well, number one, they're indicating the effects of mining or not indicating it. Number two, you might be surprised. When these things are added up in the stream and they affect particularly this overall conductivity or specific conductance, they do have rather striking effects on the ecology of the stream. And I've done a series of studies, for example, on fish, one in particular, in which a difference between a conductivity of, say, 275 and 400 changed the reproduction of a fish from, like, having no babies to having 50 or 60 babies. And this is in a fish which is more estuarine. So what happens is, if you change the chemistry, even in something that's not toxic, it changes the background conditions and enables some species to outcompete others, whereas previously they did not. So for example, many of these streams now are crammed with exotic species, some of which, like various kinds of tilapia, these cichlid fish, are tolerant of estuarine conditions. So if you take our pure, very, very clean original streams and put in even these non-toxic materials but raise the specific conductance, you enable these exotic species to outcompete the native species even more readily than they do normally. Next slide. Same thing would be true of magnesium. There's not as much difference between magnesium and the clean streams and the dirty streams. Next slide. Okay, now sulfate is a really interesting one. It's incredibly low in the St. Mary's and in Horse, a lot higher in the Myakka. And this is where you'd have to go and try to figure out, where is that coming from? Is it coming from some small mine influences up there, or is there some weird agricultural influence? My guess, for example, would be, this is due, we have a huge problem in the Myakka above Myakka State Park, in that the agricultural row crops are pumping up groundwater, putting it on their crops, and then dumping it in the river. Killed off Flatford Swamp, and the river is way too high, in the wintertime. Some of this water probably contains a lot of sulfates, and that may be essentially, this is an indicator of groundwater, not of some other things which are actually happening. So if it is an indicator, it's telling us something weird like that is going on. Next slide. Now this is the very best one for looking at mine effects, and you can see why, because all three of our clean to relatively clean streams are less than 0.5 milligrams per liter fluoride, and all of our mine impacted streams are way above that. Let me look and see what the guys decreed. So they had actually two different levels of either 1.5 or 4. So some of the streams were set at 1.5, which actually isn't too crazy, but the 4 is way, way out of sight. Next slide. Now, the same thing is true with phosphorus, that the clean streams are relatively low. It's interesting that Pain Creek is so low, given its history, although it's not as polluted from active mines now as it used to be, but certainly the Peace River and the South Prong have a huge amounts of phosphorus in it. But phosphorus is complicated. This is total phosphorus, and you need to look at, like, you know, the different types of phosphorus, how much of it is associated with particles. So, you know, you'd need to get a lot more sophisticated to determine exactly how much phosphorus, how you would want to set that level. Next slide. Okay, well, we got these differences in water quality. We can attribute them to mining and agriculture, and we can compare these with streams that are relatively little impacted. But what does this have to do with anything? Are these really issues which deserve making a socioeconomic impact? You know, are we going to require these companies to do this? It's going to cost money. You know, why are we bothered? Next slide. I'm just going to give you a few examples. You heard about one of them this morning. Or maybe you didn't hear this part of the story, but of course, this is a processing plant that was run by Mulberry Corporation, which went bankrupt. Next slide. And they had these huge gyp stacks there, which you can see in the background. And of course, at the time, we were getting a lot of rain, believe it or not, you know, and I'm sure those days will come again. So they had all this water, and what the heck are they going to do with it? And they started dumping it into the nearby estuary. Next slide. And what happened was, like, this is an aerial view, which may not look too weird to you, but all those little speckles and all that junk, like when you get down lower, next slide, it turns out it's just, it's an absolute pit of algae, just absolutely full of algae. So this was Bishop Harbor, and so they were just dumping this stuff, dumping it, and somebody noticed that, well, this doesn't look right, you know, because you go in the next little bay down below and there's almost no algae. It was mainly a thing called ulva, or sea lettuce, which is extremely good at taking nitrogen in water and using it to grow really, really fast. And although we don't know for 100% that it was the nitrogen, that's the suspect anyway in this particular case. Next slide. A second case that I wanted to give you of how water quality from mine sites can have a considerable effects on the fauna living in the streams is in the course of this Ona Fort Grain mine case that I was involved in. We were presented with six restored mine sites. I don't like to use the word restored. I mean, they're not restored to anything that was ever on this earth. You know, I call them alternative ecosystems. They're just really, really weird. You know, the soils are totally wrong. The plant life and the animal life is wrong. You know, the water chemistry is wrong. Yet these sites, particularly the Halls Branch site, had been trumpeted in the scientific literature. There's a guy who publishes papers. There's a consultant who claims how wonderful this site is. The Florida DEP had released the bond on this site. And when I testified at trial and used the data that you're going to see here, which are devastating, are showing these, you know, big effects, bad effects of water quality on the animals living in the stream, DEP sent a lawyer down to the trial, and her argument was there could not be any pollution because the bond had been released. You know, and she sat in an open courtroom and made this argument, and there was a long discussion amongst the judges and the lawyers about this. I mean, it's just total nonsense. You know. Four of these sites are in Hillsborough County, just in the upper reaches of the South Fork of the Alafaya. Two of them are just over in Polk County, sort of in that same general region. Next slide. When I first visited one of these sites, and this was standing in the revegetated wetland, which has cypress trees and everything, it actually looks kind of nice. It's just that 95% of the site is just bare soil with kogan grass growing on it, really awful. But I took one look at this, and having studied, you know, coal mine sites in Pennsylvania, I knew instantly, what does this red kind of yellow color in the stream indicate? And it's iron. It's iron oxide precipitates. You know, it's whether it's iron 3 or iron 5, you get red or yellow. In fact, in Pennsylvania, they call this, you know, yellow boy or something. So I knew that there had to be something wrong with this. So even if the water quality itself was not killing things, all this precipitate, you know, that's flocculent on the bottom is very, very bad for the stream. Next slide. This is a long story that would actually, you know, take a whole conference to deal with all by itself. But generally in ecotoxicology, you know, it's more complicated than just is this like bad or not. The first thing you probably do is you take a water sample you take it, and under control conditions, you determine whether or not this water is toxic to standard bioassay organisms. But these are generally organisms that do not live in the stream. These are things cultivated in the lab that are very well defined, and you know, these are classic tests. For example, we'll be talking today about the thing called Ceriodaphnia, which is a little crustacean which grows and reproduces in the lab, and it's used in the standard assay. We'll also be talking about a frog embryo teratogenesis test, or FETAX. The second thing is there toxicity for native species? You know, the things that are actually living there, because who cares whether an African frog lives or dies in this thing? You care about, you know, do leopard frogs live or die, or green frogs in this pond? Although you're going to be worried about it if the embryos of this African frog, which used to be used for pregnancy tests, by the way. Is anyone old enough to remember when you had to go to the doctor and they would inject your urine into this frog, and if it laid eggs, that meant you were pregnant? That's how long we have come, baby. One of the ways of knowing whether or not something is going wrong with a native species is whether or not things are missing. So, for example, you go in there and look at all the critters that are there, and you compare them to a good stream somewhere nearby, and maybe the fish are missing, maybe some of the invertebrates are missing. Then you would want to know, well, what is this toxicity due to, and where is it coming from? Now, this is a considerably very detailed study that would have to be done on every site if you really wanted to understand what was happening. Next slide. So all we did was to do Tier 1. We took the water back to the lab, to a company called WAR, Water and Air Research in Gainesville. And here are the six sites. So here's the crustacean Ceriodaphnia thing, which is a great assay because the animal actually reproduces. So a lot of times adult animals will survive a long time, but the babies and the eggs will not. And then this frog embryogenesis teratogenic amphibian xenopus. So that's the frog embryo test. So wherever there's a plus, that means we got a hit. That is, we got a positive effect of toxicity. So you can see they were all toxic at growth. One gave malformed embryos, and people have heard a lot now about, you know, the frogs in Minnesota that have all these extra limbs and all these weird things, and that looks like it's some kind of an interaction actually between parasites and pollution in water. And then two of them affected reproduction in the crustacean. And remember, these are not, you know, bare mine sites. These are their best of the best restored so-called mine sites. This is as good as it gets. And they led us there, you know, saying, oh, well, you're not going to find anything wrong with this. You know, all our scientists tell us these sites are great. And the most preliminary look showed us that there was massive toxicity in these sites. So you can imagine what all the rest of them are like before they were so-called restored. Next slide. This just lists some of the water chemistry that we measured, like some of the other things that USGS does not measure, you know, different kinds of metals. And right away, if you just kind of, the take-home story is it's extremely variable, and this also varies over time. And this is the thing I'm going to come back to. You can't go in and just take a water sample and go home and measure it. You have to continually take samples, and you have to try to figure out when the water is going to be the most polluted. And this tends to be the first rainfall of the season, although it would depend on, you know, when they're discharging things. Next slide. Now, here's some data that were actually taken by the miners and by Swift Mud, and they actually measured tributaries to Horse Creek, you know, not particularly near any mines, but which might be polluted. And they, again, used our friend Ceriodaphnia. Rather than frogs, they used two fish, a shiner and a fathead minnow. So A stands for acute toxicity, which means quick toxicity, maybe within a couple of days. And C stands for chronic toxicity. So here again, and a lot of the sites just picked as random of these streams running into Horse Creek, there's a lot of toxicity. So this is obviously very, very common, given that these were just snapshots that we just went out there and took. Then again, these were done by the mining company themselves. Next slide. So, you know, there's a lot more than I've said today about the Horse Creek Stewardship Program, but it is a very minimal thing. The reason that the Horse Creek Stewardship Program is so important is they're planning on using this as a model for all of the other mines. Or is it considered to be so successful and so good that it should be repeated, you know, under these other kinds of mining conditions. And of course, Charlotte County commissioners, by a vote of 4-1, approved a compact, you know, with Mosaic, and they haven't. All they promised in this compact was that there would be a monitoring program. And what we hear from behind the scenes is this will be the program, you know, as flawed as it is. So what I'm recommending as a minimum is that the trigger levels need to be reset and obviously done in some kind of real scientific manner. You need to have sampling sites. They had 4 sampling sites just kind of picked along the stream. You know, you have to have sampling sites above and below each point of discharge from the mine. You can't just take them average here or there. You also need to have more of these samples, particularly taken, you know, before and after rainfall. You need to have not just the biomonitoring, which they are going to do. They were going to go out and just do field collections of animals. You need to use the entire system that I'm suggesting, you know, taking this, testing it in the lab, you know, looking for missing species, and then going back and looking for specific, what is it in this water? We have no idea right now what it is in the water that's causing these impacts, and it may be different things. And next slide. And then finally, you just need to redo this plan completely. You know, it needs to be done in public, or at the very minimum, it needs to be done with people from outside, you know, scientists with real qualifications who can provide an unbiased point of view and say, well, this is what would be best for the people, for the environment, you know, not for the mining companies. And the best way to do that is to convene an outside panel, and by outside I mean as far away from here or wherever the mine site is as possible, ideally completely outside Florida. But it has to be someone who has no financial ties with DEP, with the water district, with the county, or with the mining companies. You know, it can't be anybody who has these conflicts, because as it is now, we have this consulting system set up whereby the consultants are providing advice which is against the people's interest. It always favors the political industry point of view because they are the people who are paying them. And ideally, you would even have a panel that served for some considerable length of time to kind of oversee, you know, the actual implementation of this. And then finally, last slide. This is a sign that I picked up a couple of years ago over near Rotunda. And it kind of illustrates the whole philosophy, like people are always talking about dying the death of 1,000 cuts. But there's more to it than that. If you visualize the words here and the message as being communities, you know, natural communities, you know, and the impacts of pollution and development and all the other things we do that are detrimental as being the bullet holes, you know, you can keep shooting in this for a long period of time and people think things are going pretty good. Like, the general point of view around here, promulgated even by groups like the Charlotte Harbor NEP, which is part of the EPA system, is, you know, things are really going pretty good. You know, Charlotte Harbor is pretty clean and things are okay. You know, they're not okay. Charlotte Harbor is immensely polluted. You know, there's all kinds of adverse impacts, and people are just kidding themselves because they always want to, you know, put in one more pipe or take one more amount of water or do something else which is nasty. And I really like the idea somebody mentioned about putting a piece of velvet with a tiny little hole down over the mine, and that's what we need, is we need, you know, truly an assessment of the cumulative impacts of all of these things, because, you know, they're all connected together. Thank you.
If maybe time for one or two questions for Dr. Dunson? Or we can wait till the panel at the end of the day. Yes, sir.
What did you say caused the occurrence of an extra appendage in frogs? A combination of parasites and toxins?
Yeah, the latest thing is that it's related to a parasitic infection of a fluke. But it's also got, it has to do as well, you know, with aspects of pollution. Like, a lot of the death of frogs now is believed to be due to a fungus called, what is it, Clostridiosis or something like that. And again, what we don't know yet is how the, you know, the environment, which has to do with, you know, chemicals in the environment, which are of human origin, interact with these biological things. But that definitely seems to have to be related to parasitism. But somehow the parasitism, which is out of whack and is way beyond, you know, the normal.
I've seen that in and Lyme ticks, prostate Lyme ticks.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow. Let me give you my card. Let me know when you... Do you have any pictures of that? That'll get people's attention big time. Yeah, if you can find, you know, dead fish or even better, abnormal frogs, oh, wow, that would be a big one.
You mean with
lighting
off the legs?
Yeah.
Well, thank you. Wow. What a boon to the restaurant business. I'm sorry. I just wanted to make one comment that kind of ties into the comment you just made about Charlotte Carter. You know, I don't want to be the person to burst over there, the person that burst everybody's bubble, but Horse Creek is in crisis right now. Crisis from the mining that has gone on all in that upper watershed right now. You know, maybe comparing it to everything that's already been literally completely mined, it looks, you know, pristine, but it is in serious trouble. And I wanted to ask you, the high levels of several of those minerals, do you think that's the result of all of the deeper groundwater that they're pumping up as part of that mine process and discharging into the surrounding tributaries? Or do you, you know, where do you think that high mineralization is coming up? Because, you know, you mentioned that that isn't necessarily toxic, and I'm sure you're speaking from an animal perspective, but that mineralization is highly toxic to native vegetation that is adapted to those blackwater stream, you know, systems. They are virtually devoid of, you know, nutrients and minerals. They've got that highly acidic water that's, you know, coming out of the superficial aquifer. And that's one of the big problems that occurred with the Flatford Swamp area. In addition to altering the hydro period, they had that highly mineralized water that they were pumping into that system that absolutely cannot tolerate, you know, that mineralized water.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. But if the data are available, I haven't seen them yet, that would discriminate between, you know, effects of metals or whatever, you know. Even sulfate, for example, high sulfate levels are believed to be potentially damaging to, say, frog eggs, but there's very little real good data on that.
Well,
so.
I know you've belittled the Southwest Florida Water Management District, but out of all of the districts, they have actually produced some scientific documents that are pretty impressive, and they came out years ago. And they may not be doing any of that anymore, but one of the things that they were doing, of course, that was the first area that they were doing the municipal well fields, and basically their models, they were looking at their models, and their models were telling them that there was, you know, no interaction with the superficial aquifer. And of course, the cattlemen who saw all the ponds dry up and all the locals that were living in Mount Pasco County who were having their natural lakes sucked dry kept saying, there's a problem here. Well, their solution was, because the pumping, the significant pumping was dewatering their wetlands on their preserve sites, they decided that the solution would be to pump more water from the Gordon Aquifer and just dump some of it into those depressional wetlands to rehydrate them. And of course, that water that they were dumping into it was highly mineralized water from Florida, and trees went out like that. So I think probably they would have fared far better without water than they would have by having that Florida water dumping.
Well, after my experiences down here for the last 10, 15 years, although I'm a long-term, you know, eco-crazy Democrat, I'm ready to vote for any Republican that would do away with all government control of, you know, things like water and bring it. It needs to be brought down to the local level as much as possible, because that's the only hope the people really have of, you know, expressing their points.
Is this available on your
TMPL
discussion? Is there a copy of that available to take out?
This presentation?
His presentation?
We're talking about the TMDL.
Right, your discussion and the slides and what they're proposing and what you think.
Yeah, that'll be on the website if she puts it there.
Okay, sure. Great.